closer.
You are listening to Two Magicians, One Mic.
Hey everybody, welcome to Two Magicians, One Mic. My name is Nick Paul, and Simon Cornell is far away in puzzle land right now, because when you create something that's successful, it requires lots of work. But with me is my good buddy and fake TV show, talk show co-host friend. It's Taylor Hughes, everybody.
Hey everybody. Hey Nick.
Taylor, we brought you on. Well, I brought you on because you just had a new a special come out on Vimeo. And it's at chasingwonder.tv. It's your first special. You produced it. You got everything. You got people showed up. You had a nice, you got a standing ovation. It looks like a real comedy special. It's just, I would like to applaud you on that, because that is not an easy, there are so many things that could have gone wrong and it looks perfect. And I just finished watching it.
So many things that did go wrong. Oh, thank you. Wow.
Well, if they did, you cut around it very well. You couldn't tell.
Oh, no, thanks, man. It's funny, ever since I was a kid and watching like Harry Anderson's Tricks of the Trade and you know, all the specials we watched growing up, it was something I always wanted to do. And then I realized one day, nobody is going to ask me to do this, so I just make it. And I've talked about that for years. And then last August, I was in Nashville, and a buddy of mine, I'm telling him the story about how I think I'm going to make a special. And as he sat there quietly listening to me ramble on, at the end of it, he said, "You told me the same exact thing last year. When are you going to do it?"
Yeah.
And I said, "I don't know, January." And he took out his phone and bought a plane ticket to L.A. and said, "Now you got to do it." So that's kind of how
only
it happened.
People in Nashville can afford to do that in L.A.
Right.
They'd be like, "Oh, that's nice."
Right.
And then forget about it 5 minutes later.
In L.A.
That's what people in L.A. do.
In L.A., if I was shooting in Glendale, they'd be like, "Well, tell me how it goes."
It's so far away. You mean I got to get on the 134? Oh my goodness.
Right, right. What if I have to take the 2?
That's something I remember Judd Apatow telling a young Jason Segel. It's like, nobody's going to, and I'm not saying this about you, but for
right,
him
no,
especially.
No, it's absolutely true.
Nobody's going to cast you. Nobody's going to write anything for you because you're not leading man.
Right, right.
You're not going to go into the audition and go, "Oh, this guy should star in a television show," or, you know, have his own special. So he took that upon himself to write all his own things and be motivated in that way. And I think that's, especially nowadays, like, you have to. And that's great.
Oh, thanks, man. Yeah, it is that thing of you realize one day that nobody else is waking up and going, I wonder if Nick Paul's career is going well and he's fulfilled and doing all the things he wants to do. You know what I mean? Like, you're the only one at the end of the day who not only is thinking about your life or your career, but is responsible to make sure something happens with it. So
I was playing video games with my buddies yesterday, and they both went to the same college. My one buddy I've known since middle school, and the other buddy I met after college, but they went to the same college, and they were talking about, "Hey, remember so-and-so? Whatever happened to that person?" And I'm just thinking, how many people are thinking about that of
right?
me?
Yeah.
Like, what's that guy doing? That magician guy, what's he doing?
Right. Right. Well, and magic in and of itself, I think people don't think of magicians. All we think about is magic, right? But then most people aren't thinking about magic at all. Most people haven't ever seen magic live. So the idea that, you know, someone's going like, "Oh, you know, let's hire this person, or let's do a project with this person." I think it's a good thing just to, if you really think you should do something, then you should just do it. Even if you have
told
to spend
me the
a bunch
day
of, money.
Of you were just terrified, like,
oh yeah,
because I get nervous all the time for shows, but you don't strike me as somebody who gets nervous that often.
I enjoyed the show and I enjoyed the people. The prepping for this thing was very exciting, and then the day it actually happened, first of all, I had just gotten over, I was pretty darn sick leading up to it. And then we're filming at the castle, and when we showed up at the castle and, you know, had gone through all the procedure of getting approvals and paperwork and all this stuff that you got to do to be able to film in a place that usually doesn't let you film, when we finally showed up and they turned the cameras on, I was like, what am I doing? What makes me think this is a good idea at all? you know?
What's the biggest thing you have to get over doing? Like, people are like, oh, you're a performer. That's great. You get up on stage and make people happy. But really, you're just jumping over just boxes of hurdles of why am I doing this? Because I think the biggest, your biggest critic is yourself. If you're not a sociopath, and we know several sociopath performers.
But I mean, that's the whole reason I even have a podcast called About to Break is that every performer is constantly, it seems like all performers to some extent have a bit of imposter syndrome, you know, where we feel like we shouldn't be there, we shouldn't have an opportunity, or we shouldn't, you know, who are we to do anything? And I think that, you know, if that kind of stuff gets in your head and you think that that means there's something wrong with you, no, I think there'd be something wrong with you if you didn't question picking up a microphone and talking to strangers.
Yeah, all these people now have to listen to me and watch me perform this thing that I've been working on my whole life.
Right.
Hope it doesn't suck.
Right. Well, and you work on a thing and you like it. It's something that you enjoy and, you know, you've done it in front of audiences. But it is that thing of like, oh, if this is the worst show I've ever done, I'm now documenting it. You know, I've spent a ton of money. I've flown people out. I flew out a television crew, which is a whole nother story. You know, we live in the capital of television.
Yeah. And let's talk about that. Was it like, did they win a contest or something?
They found a golden ticket. No, so my world is event entertainment. I do about 80% of my year is spent doing these large corporate gatherings that usually have quite a bit of production level as far as staging and lighting and IMAG and all of this. And so when I was thinking about who I wanted to have film this, I have a lot of friends like you do. We have a lot of friends who work in the industry and a lot of people, you know, people who are camera operators and things like that. But I needed a team of people that I knew I wouldn't have to babysit. Like, I didn't want to have any thoughts about the production. I just wanted to do the show and know they were going to get it. And I had worked with this team called Let People See, who's a group out of they're back east. And I thought, you know, every event I've ever done with them where they've run it, it's not like a TV show where you can go like, okay, let's take another take. They only have one chance to get, you know, they've got to get the shot. They've got to get the
take.
And they're
working with like CEOs and stuff who are, you know, awful on stage a lot of the time.
Right.
And they're making them look great.
Right, right, right. Yeah, we do these conferences and, you know, you see them. They're very stealth. Like, you don't even really notice them during the day. They're just so like, they're like ninjas, you know, with cameras. And then the next day you turn up and they've edited an entire recap of the day before. And it's just beautifully polished. And I just thought, you know what? These are my buddy Chris owns the company. And I just thought, you know what? I would rather bite the bullet and take the, spend the investment to know that it's people that kind of have seen me and know my stuff. And it made a big difference.
That's kind of what you have to do is like, you know, I like to be in control of everything, as I'm sure my wife could tell you. But I'm learning that you need to hire the right people and just trust the right people to go, okay, I think it was, what's his name? Will Ferrell and Adam McKay. Adam McKay was saying, you hire people you need to not like, if you're the director, you need not to direct those people because they like you hired them for a reason and they know what they're doing.
Yeah.
And in this case, that was smart of you because you could have easily brought in people who've worked on television and, you know, cinematographers here, but that's a very different ball game than shooting a live show because it's essentially in real time. Even though you did two shows, it's still in real time.
Right. Right. And, you know, I did think like, okay, I've got enough friends that have cameras and know what they're doing that we could kind of pull this together. But I just thought if we're going to do it, let's really make the investment and do it right. And I'm pleased with how it came out. I'm also really glad that I captured the show, you know, before I took a 5-month break of not performing.
Well, it's a good thing it wasn't set for March, you know, 18th when we all went to lockdown.
Right. Oh yeah. Yeah. We recorded back in January and I had no idea. I mean, I wonder if I knew if I would have depleted my savings making a comedy special, if I knew I would not have any work for the next year or whatever.
Well, that's the joy of this business. You have no, I think to this year where there's, you know, very little going on, excuse me, career wise. And then last year I was still in the same anxieties and freak out modes of like, oh, I don't know what I'm going to be doing the next couple of months. And then stuff just showed up.
Right.
And, you know, this is the accumulation of all my fears and anxieties. And you're like, well, all right, this is it.
Yeah. You know, it's kind of like when you do stand up, the whole idea of going on stage and bombing is so terrifying. But then once you do it, you go, oh, well, I've done that. I know how it feels. It's not great, but I'm not. It's kind of like getting punched in the face. You're scared your whole life someone's going to punch you. And then when you get punched in the face, you're like, well, now I'm not scared that's going to happen, you know?
Yeah, I had a great improv teacher who told us that. Like, purposely go to do an open mic and purposely bomb.
Right.
I don't have the balls to do it, but right. I should have. But it was great advice because then you know you can come out on the other side and you're still alive.
Absolutely, man. And I think that's one thing about this whole pandemic and COVID and everything that, you know, it's kind of shut down our industry. I think one of the good things about it is those of us that stay in the business, I think we'll be a little less fearful. You know, it's because it's like, what's the worst that could happen? Every time I thought, what's the worst that could happen? I never thought that there would be zero shows. You know, I'd be like, well, maybe the cruise industry tanks, or maybe, you know, maybe theaters aren't booking, or maybe corporates aren't doing stuff, or maybe there's no private parties. I never once thought that overnight all of that would be gone, right? But now you go like, oh, well, I'm not scared of that. I survived. Still.
Yeah. Yeah.
Still going.
Keep going. We're like the Energizer Bunny. I want to steer it away from, I'm sure everybody's sick of hearing about that because we've talked about it to death.
Right, that's right,
but
yeah.
what was something that ended up working out in your favor with shooting this that you didn't expect? Like something maybe you were worried about that actually ended up being a blessing.
Yeah. Okay. So I was thinking we did two shows. We did a 7 o'clock and a 9 o'clock, and we shot at my favorite theater in LA, Dynasty Typewriter. It's just this little gym in the worst little area. It's like an industrial area next to MacArthur Park. There's no restaurants around. Like, there's nothing over there. And then there's just this beautiful, gorgeous theater in the middle of everything. And we did a 7 o'clock and a 9 o'clock. And I was thinking, okay, I'm gonna do a mix. I'll probably edit a mix of some good things that go good at the 7 o'clock, some things that go good at the 9 o'clock. But we did the 7 o'clock, and luckily that first show was pretty great. Like the audience was just on point, and you know, I didn't fumble too much, and things really kind of felt good. And because they felt good, the 9 o'clock, I was able to just cut loose and have fun with, cause I wasn't going like, oh, I got to make sure we get this routine. And so that 9 o'clock show, I wasn't planning on it, but like, it just became this fun, like a lot of improv, a lot of really crazy stuff happened. And I just went with it. And I probably wouldn't have if I was worried that, you know, we needed to get a perfect take or something like that.
Yes. When Stephen Colbert took over the late show and he was told they're going to be doing double shows on Thursdays, so they didn't have to shoot on Fridays, he was like, that sounds terrible. But now he talks about it like it's his favorite thing, because that second show, I think someone described it to him as like, this is how every show should feel to you now, because you're in just such a different mode and a different state of mind.
Absolutely.
And you're not as fearful. And I'm like that too. When you do a week of shows at the Castle, that, you know, by the third show, you're not even in your head at all anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. That's why places like the Castle or House of Cards or anywhere you do an extended run, you know, the Loft in Lake Tahoe, these are like, there's nothing better than just doing the thing over and over as many times as you can. You know, you put something in at the beginning of the week that you're not so sure about. And by the end of it, sometimes you go, well, that was terrible. And sometimes you go, wow, this is really like, it's got legs, you know, you've got something to work with.
Yeah. Even if something doesn't work, you're like, whatever. Rest of the show is fine.
Right. Yeah. And that also helps too. Like I used to have such a hard time. I shouldn't say used to, like, I still have a hard time when a show doesn't go the way I want, or if it's a little rougher than I'd like it to be. But when you're doing that many shows, like we both did a run in Branson where you're doing, you know, in 6 weeks, you're doing like an insane amount of shows. If one doesn't go good, you're kind of like, well, there's another one coming up right after this, you know,
That's probably the biggest thing. Yeah. I miss about doing tons and tons of shows. Just that freedom to just not be, I'm always nervous about the show starting and doing the show, but I'm right. It's a different type of nervous. It's not like, oh God, everything's going to fall apart. It's, well, you know, I'm just, you got butterflies. Mm-hmm. And there's something that comes with doing a million shows in a week that, and it's kind of hard to describe until you do it.
Right. Right. Well, and that's another thing too, why I wanted to do the special is I've been doing the routines that are on the special, quite a few of them I've been working on for several years. And because my stuff, a lot of it's storytelling based, I feel like there's a certain point in telling a story where you've told it too much and you start to lose a little bit of the connection to it.
A lot of stand-ups talk about that where they're like, you know, they'll write their hour special and then, you know, they're just ready to be done with it within a year.
Right. Right. And which is kind of counterintuitive to most magic. Like most magicians build an act and they do the act and that's what we do, you know, our whole career. But, you know, growing up and luckily enough being close enough to the castle and being a junior member, like getting to see a lot of these great acts, I noticed really young, you know, 17, 18 years old, I'd see acts that I saw when I was, you know, 8 or 9 years old, and it was the same thing I saw them do 10 years earlier. And I just never wanted to be the guy who just does the thing. Like, I have no desire to just do the same thing forever. And so, you know, about a year and a half ago, I went, well, the best way to make sure that doesn't happen is to burn this material, like put it out there. You know, magic's based on a surprise. So if people are seeing it, they've seen it, they usually don't want to see that same thing again. So I'm like, well, just put it out there and start over. And so now I'm in this weird spot of having to write a whole new, new show.
Well, I guess the advantage for you is like, yeah, for public shows, you have to write a whole new show. But for corporate events and private shows, they're probably not going to have seen. Most of the time you show up to a corporate and they have no idea who you are. They didn't even know there was going to be a magician. So there's a little less pressure, I think, on you than. But even I'm sure I know Jerry Seinfeld still kind of has his act stuff that he rotates. But even guys who throw out stuff are going to go back to that material because a lot of comedians do corporate events to pay the bills because it pays stupid amounts of money.
Totally, man. And I think, you know, it's one thing Katie and I have talked about, like I will still do some of these routines, but because especially when you're doing them, you know, every night or several times a night for months or years, you kind of want to capture them on video when they're at the best they're going to be. You know, I feel like some of these things, even now, you know, after 4 months of no shows, if I picked up and did one of these routines now, it wouldn't be the same as it was on video, you know? So
sure. Yeah. I think there's a couple really great story moments in the special. My favorite is kind of your first time performing at a birthday and then the way the kid reacted to that. That was a great spin on things. Cause I think everybody thinks it's going to be this negative story. Mm. And then the other one is your Rubik's Cube routine, which anytime I'm performing for magicians, I now open my Rubik's Cube routine with, I'm not going to do a trick with a Rubik's Cube because no other magicians are currently doing Rubik's Cube magic.
Right?
If you're a magician, you know, everybody is, but yours is unique because you've found a deeper layer to it. And I apologize if I've subconsciously said a few of your lines in my show, because you've helped me with mine so greatly and you've made my routine so much better. But the Instagram story and the way we think our lives are going to be is just such a powerful moment. And it cuts to the audience and you just see, even I know there's a lot of magicians in that audience, which is very difficult. And you see them perk up and then go, oh, that is a fascinating point that no one has ever touched upon with doing a Rubik's Cube routine. Where do you think that came from?
Thanks, man. There's two moments in the show that made me laugh with magicians because we had a lot of magician friends come out from the castle, and I honestly didn't know some of them were going to be there till I walked out and saw like this whole row of magicians. And so,
which is usually like my nightmare.
Right. So, but there was two moments. There was that, the one where I brought out the Rubik's Cube and you see the looks of like, huh. And then later in the routine when they see kind of the twist and it's like, okay. Yeah. I like that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, with the Rubik's Cube routine specifically, I don't love Rubik's Cube magic. I never really have. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but it just hasn't connected with me on a magical level. You know, usually if somebody shows they can solve a Rubik's Cube and then that Rubik's Cube matches another thing later, I'm not impressed. You know, it's kind of like when we do card tricks and we say, you know, it's cool to do a lot of cardistry and things, but if you come up to a table and you do these crazy maneuvers with cards flying everywhere and you've got complete control of each one, it's not really impressive when their card goes from the middle of the deck to the top of the deck, you know? So I feel like I'm rambling there. But
no, I think a lot of magicians kind of, like, that's one of the best things I learned from working with Zabrecki, who's been a good friend of mine for a couple of years now, is like, you get one pick a card trick in a show.
Right.
And I think it's the same with a Rubik's Cube routine. You get to do it once. And there are guys that clearly are the exception to the rule and do their whole show as a Rubik's Cube thing.
Right.
That's just not my cup of tea. But I'm not saying that's a poor decision. I'm saying that's a choice they've made and they do it well. But
right.
I think the way you and I see it is, okay, you do the thing, you prove you can do the thing, and then you move on to something else.
Well, yeah, you know, Jeff Hobson was the one I first heard talk about this idea of doing a routine that you don't love you don't love the trick, but the trick provides you a vehicle to do something you really want to do. So, for example, he talks about Professor's Nightmare, you know, the three different ropes, and then they become the same length, and then they go back to being three different ropes. And he talks about how he doesn't like that trick, but that trick allows him to steal three watches, which is the only reason he does it. The Rubik's Cube trick for me is a storytelling vehicle. I wanted to illustrate. I love the fact that, you know, magic is, we're demonstrating illusions and we're showing, you know, here's something that's not real, but it feels real. And I wanted to demonstrate that every day in life, when we go online and we're comparing ourselves to everyone else and it looks like they're perfect and we're not, that's an illusion. It's a complete illusion that we just buy into. Right. And so for me, that the idea of the Rubik's Cube and always trying to get it perfect and, you know, thinking that the solution is just to get it the way another one looks, I connected with that so much. And so that's kind of why that became such a big part of the show, is I wanted to talk about those things.
I think what you and I have become buddies, because I feel like we're a minority in magic, where we are magicians who wish we were just comedians. where a lot of magicians are people who think who really want to have magical powers.
Right.
And I don't say that negatively, and I don't say that, you know, to put anybody down. But I think a lot of people go, wouldn't it be cool if I could do this? Let me figure out how to do that. And I'm not negating anybody. I'm just saying, for you, for the purpose of kind of the special and why you and I are friends, we use, like you were talking about, the Rubik's Cube as a storytelling vehicle. We are using magic to get to something else, I think, a lot of the time.
Well, you know, the thing that got me interested in magic, and this kind of goes back to the whole title of the show, is Chasing Wonder, is it chasing that feeling you had the first time you saw magic, the first time you saw something that was absolutely impossible and yet you were seeing it happen with your own eyes. That's the moment. Like, you know, people always will ask us as magicians, is there no fun for you now that you know how the tricks work? And I go, no, because I remember the moment that I saw this thing and it blew my mind. And now I get to see people's reaction at the moment they have that kind of realization, right? That's the thing that I love about magic. It's not the tricks. It's not the apparatus. It's not the, you know, the history. I love the history of magic. But like, for me, it's that moment. And when I realized you can get that same moment telling a joke, sharing a story, right? Creating a moment between two people on stage with an effect. It doesn't have to just be magic to feel like magic. And that's one of the things I love about really good comedy or, you know, storytelling, is it takes us to a different place. And at the end of the day, I think, you know, Ivan Pacell was the first one I heard say it, and I quote him all the time. But every time I pack for a show, I just think, if I was just one suitcase funnier, like, you know, like, if I could just, walk out on stage.
Every time I'm like lugging all my crap onto a cruise ship. And then I see I'm standing next to the comedian and he has a backpack.
Right. And it's not
for a week.
It's not that we don't love magic. It's just that, like, you know, to me, that's real magic. You know, you look at I just watched Dave Chappelle just put out another, like, randomly just today, put out a video of like 27 minutes of him sharing about things that are going on right now. And I mean, he just speaks and everyone is captivated and encouraged and educated and challenged to think about life differently. And I go, that's magic. You know, it's not just where's the Queen of Hearts? So,
yeah, I think that's the biggest thing I struggle with Magic, and it's, you know, spending years at the castle has kind of changed my perspective, but I've always felt that, you know, we're tricking the audience in one way, and then we're tricking them in another way.
How so?
That we're trying to like convince them we're something that we're not.
I mean, I always like
getting to be to like an honest point with the audience. I don't want them to see me as, you know, a weird sideshow piece. I want them to see me as a human. And I think you do a very good job of that in this special.
Thank you, man. I try to, and I don't always do this. I mean, some of the things that we say are theater, you know, and every time you tell a story, it does evolve a little bit from the original time or the very first experience. And I mean, I've heard Penn talk about that in the way Teller tells stories, that, you know, it's always a little bit different, a little more grandiose, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's not true, you know? So I realize with the show that things evolve and change, and it's not, maybe all the details are exactly the same, but I really try to live by this motto of like being a magician who doesn't lie to the audience. Like, I honestly think you can do an entire magic show where you trick people. I don't know if I said this on a special, but sometimes I say, you know, I'll trick you, but I won't cheat or I won't lie. There's a difference.
Yeah, that's not in the special. No.
Yeah, so that's something that I kind of try to. I just feel like the more genuine things are, the better I connect with them, and then I've noticed the more the audience will connect with them. You know, people.
Yeah, I remember disagreeing with a mentalist friend of mine. I remember years ago saying I want every line in the show to be truthful, even if it's like vague to the point like where you're doing a switch and saying I won't switch this, but you know, wording it in a way that, you know, I'm not switching it. You know, right. And he's saying, I don't think you need to do that. But to me, it is just an added layer of honesty and connection, I think, with the audience.
Right. Right. And it's not about like overproving it. I mean, I think about Darren Brown. Darren Brown constantly goes like, look, this is fake. What I'm doing is not real. I don't have powers. And then people will turn around and be like, no, you really have, you know what I mean? So it's not about trying to prove it to them. I think so much of it is getting your act to a place that you are comfortable with what you're saying and sharing, and that you're not just saying it because it came, you know, on the paper with the apparatus. Like you're saying something that you genuinely connect and are leaving an audience with something more than just, you know, giving them an experience. It's not just I saw some cool stuff. I saw a guy do some things I can't do.
Sure. Yeah. 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 And, I don't know. How do you feel? You feel everything? You feel good about everything that came out?
I feel good. You know, it's funny. I questioned for a long time, is this the right time to put a special out? You know, is this the time to, I didn't want to, first of all, you know, with the pandemic and everything happening, it's not like I'm going to go tour off of this or something. Second of all, with all the amazing awareness that's happening right now in society, and the conversations we're having about racism and inequality and all these things that have been going on for way too long, I didn't want to detract from that. But I also realized that, you know, the one good thing about the special is it's something you can watch with your kids. It's something you can, you know, watch with the family. I don't agree that you have to be clean, but the special is completely clean. And so I thought, well, this might be a way for people to get together and to laugh and to have, not an escape, because I don't think we should stop talking about the things that we're talking about or forget about the things that are going on. But just a time to have a little bit of joy in a moment that, you know, I've struggled to find some during like the whole COVID thing and all of that. So I thought we'd put it out. And then this week that it comes out, we're partnering with I shouldn't say partnering. They don't know we're doing it. I've just decided we're giving the money to an organization called The Conscious Kid, which is an incredible organization that basically helps resource communities and families, libraries and schools with books that educate kids at an early age about both, you know, kind of bringing awareness to underrepresented populations and people groups, but also, you know, encourages kids to realize at a young age that, look, we're all the same. You know, we just come in different packaging and that we should love each other. So anyone who buys a special this week, we're going to take 100% of the money and give it to that amazing organization. So
that's awesome. And it's funny, there's a few bits, monologues in the show where you are almost in a weird, even though this was taped in January, you are touching on things that are happening right now in terms of conversation and just kind of seeing things from someone else's perspective. And I'm blanking on what moment it was, but I watched it and I'm like, oh, that's really interesting. And I think it doesn't come off as preachy. It doesn't come off. It's just clearly just, you know, connecting two dots with what's happening culturally right now. And that was kind of interesting to see.
That's encouraging, man. Thanks. Thank you for that. Yeah, that was obviously, I didn't know. I wasn't predicting where things were headed.
Wow, he really is a mentalist.
He is a mentalist. Yeah, so there's a special.
Well, that's great, man. I applaud you for doing it. I think it's wonderful. I just finished it. And I think it's encouraging, you know, go out there. You know, once you can do your own thing. I guess in our case, we're kind of doing our own thing, doing our little television show every Wednesday.
Every Wednesday night, shedshow.tv.
we'll make sure we get the link working.
Once
this
we
time.
Make the link work.
We did the show Wednesday and the link was not working.
Yeah, that's right.
But I think it's encouraging. I think so many people, and I'm feeling that right now, where so many people are just like, well, how am I supposed to get this done? How am I supposed to do the thing?
Right.
And you really just have to hunker down and do it. There's,
yeah.
I have a lot of friends that are, and I'm trying not to throw them under the bus, but maybe I am by saying this. And I'm currently one of those people, I feel, where, you know, you're giving every excuse not to do the thing you're good at.
Yeah. Yeah.
And at the end of the day, you just have to do it and show up and just, in your case, you put the thing out and whatever happens with it, happens with it. I hope. Because it's very good that a lot of people see it and it eventually gets picked up on something like Netflix. And that's, I think, the ultimate goal on this. And you can cut this out if you want.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I was planning this fall. We were going to pitch it to Netflix and a couple other places and had some things lined up. And then the pandemic hit and we were going to sit on it. And I thought, you know what? I want to move on from this. I want to be able to just put this out there and let people see it. And a friend of mine, Jordan Brady, who's a director, said, you know, you could put it out. It doesn't keep you from selling it later. Just get it out there, let people see it. And if anything, it's proof of concept that it connects with folks. So yeah, we just put it out. And my buddy, Eddie Firth is the one who told me, he's a comedian. He's great. And he said, you know, done is better than good. Like at a certain point, you just got to put it out. You know, I've tweaked and edited and went like, oh, I don't know if I want to say this or put that in there, or this and that. And at a certain point, you just got to put it out there. And that's
that is the problem without having a deadline is when there's a deadline, you're forced to make these quick decisions. But if you're just sitting on it and go, well, you know, eventually, I totally get that. And I work so much better under pressure.
You just have to do it. You just have to give yourself. I mean, I'm so grateful for my buddy Vance who told me like, when's the day? And I pulled up my calendar and I was like, well, there's this one week in January where I'm not traveling, where there's nothing going on. And he just said, book it. And I was like, okay. And that was it. You know, you just give yourself a deadline. It's like you deciding you're going to start a podcast or, you know, we're going to do a show on Wednesday nights, whatever it is. Like you just say you're going to do it. Who cares if you don't know how to? Who cares if you don't have the equipment or the, I mean, you can go on YouTube and learn how to do anything. Just say you're going to do it and then follow through.
Was Vance's first name Legend of? I just pictured this like imaginary man showing up and then disappearing.
You should do a special. And then he just fades into the ether.
And your wife's like, sees you in the backyard. Who are you talking to? My buddy Vance. I don't see anybody, Taylor. There's nobody there. Well, it's great. It's, what is it? Chasingwonder.tv. If anybody, and it'll take you right to rent or purchase it.
Yep.
It's a very affordable price.
Well, thank you.
It's cheaper than a subscription to anything.
Right.
I guess that's true.
Yeah, I suppose it is.
It's cheaper than HBO, Netflix, all these things. Right. You'll get more joy out of it. Does that sell it? That probably doesn't sell it very well.
I think that was great. Thanks for having me, Nick.
Thank you, Taylor Hughes. It's Taylor Hughes, everybody.
Bye, everyone.
Thanks so much for listening to the show. Please give us 5 stars on Apple Podcast. If you really like the show, you can donate a few bucks a month on our website, twomagiciansonemike.com, or become a monthly subscriber through our Patreon link. Thanks to all the people that support the show and keep it up and running. Be sure to follow us on the interwebs at Two Magicians One Mic. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great week.